The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Well, dear friends, good afternoon, and again on behalf of American University, Washington College of Law, I would like to welcome you all to the annual Women and the Law Leadership Challenge. This is one of the ways, and a very important one, in which our institution acknowledges the invaluable contributions of outstanding women to the legal profession and supports the next generation of women leaders. We have, for a long time, recognized the importance of women to the legal profession. You all know we were the first law school in the nation and perhaps in the world, created by two courageous women in 1896, Ellen Spencer Massey and Emma Gillespie. When women, both by nature and hope, were deemed not having the ability to practice the profession. I get very nervous when people by nature, because they think something. I could rest my case just by looking at this room. And, or, for example, by all of you coming in January or early February when we give the awards to the best students of the Washington College of Law. Betty Murphy, who is here always, goes to that award. And I am sometimes counting how many men are going to get it. We will distribute 8 years, 7, perhaps. So I think if we men are going to have a future of discrimination, perhaps we need to start working hard, I think, and not blaming nature, because we will not get anywhere. But our founding mothers had that vision and the commitment that made possible a tremendous change in the nation and in the world. They were not restricted to issues involving the country. They understood the interconnectedness with world issues. And in a special Massey, for example, served as an advisor of Sweden at that time. A very important role in promoting suffrage, universal suffrage everywhere. And all these things that we take for granted. But they were the result of motivation, enthusiasm, and a commitment with justice and equality. Now, the example that was set by our founding mothers continues today in the law. Through our, for example, women and the law and domestic violence clinics, which are very important. And I would also mention the following. We don't give a tremendous importance to commercial rankings, like the U.S. has brought before, because these rankings do not take into account, for example, gender issues, or pro bono action, or diversity in the law. But I would like to mention that in spite of that fact that we don't organize our law school around rankings, and we don't use them as a recruiting tool, our clinics are in the law report number 2 in the nation, including our clinic in Women and the Law, and the clinic in domestic violence. And you would be glad to know that our international program are number 6. Trial advocacy number 10 in the nation. The new rankings, also the U.S. World Report, the new rankings on the part-time program were number 4 in the country. And we move ahead, and we are in the top tier last year, but now we are at number 45 out of 200 law schools. And you know, only 10 years ago, we were about 70 something in the second tier. So we don't put much stress in how we don't change the values of the institution that we could do, not allocating resources to our values. But in spite of that, we have moved ahead, and the women, our programs on women issues have been important in that and have been recognized. We have also a student-run law journal, the Journal of Gender, Social Policy, and the Law, that provides place to also test fundamental ideas involving equality. We have the Women and the Law Program and the Women and the International Law Program. I see Daniela Prime here, which is the executive director of that program. I think the only law school in the country with two LLM master specialization in gender and the law, where people study all international law or law and government, domestic law, and then acquires the knowledge to contribute to gender-based initiatives in the area of the law. I also would like to say, in the leadership of the school, I recognize here Christine Falle, who is an associate dean for the institution on academic affairs, and we're blessed also by having Christine Falle, the renowned professor of intellectual property and co-director of the intellectual property program, also in the leadership program. Let me see, I would like to, Teresa Feltz is here. My esteemed colleague is the director of the Legal Writing and Rhetoric Program. We are one of the few schools that have a program with six full-time faculty doing writing classes, always impressive boy of Aja. We have many other here. I mean, am I forgetting any faculty member? I see, let me see, Magarena Saez, who teaches comparative law, and is at the same time directing our dual JD program. We are one of the few schools who have dual JD program that you are 2 years here, some 2 years in France, Canada, Spain, and now Australia, and get two law degrees. In addition, we have a superb body of administrators, a senior administrator, that includes Trishana Bowden and others, those who are here, and again, that superb in terms of their contribution. I see also my colleague Colin Park, who has been in faculty in our school and has been in charge and is in charge of developing our exciting program for hosting. Well, you can see that the tradition of our founding mothers continue to be very vibrant in the institution. I would also like to say that we see that in the composition of the student body. Around 55% of the students are women, and I would say at this point over 40% of the faculty are women. So that's very important too in terms of shaping the institution. All these have been possible because of the contribution, support, and enthusiasm most of our alumni. We were talking today with some of you. We were in a law school with only 8 women at that time in the class. And you will see that what you have done has inspired many, and the law school now is the same place from the point of view of opportunity and creating possibilities for the students. But it has, you will see also in diversity and the composition of the students. It's a very diverse place too. The U.S. Economic Board has an index of diversity, which is not considered for the ranking, but they have an index of diversity, and the top tier in the United States were the school number 4 in diversity. So these are very important accomplishments also that have been covered on the basis of this founding, this compelling story of imagining a lot that will transform society by educating women and men alike in important ways. Well, today we're honoring Jess Priestley. And Jess Priestley is joining a very impressive group of Pamela Dees, the UCL class of 1993, Parnell Karen Fox. She was last year's recipient and a very important member of American University. The Board of Trustees. Pam has been a big supporter of this dimension since its creation. And her generosity has contributed greatly to the establishment of the Women and the Law Leadership Scholarship. Thank you, Pam, for your contribution. We have Karen Lockwood, class of 1978, who is here, and a partner at Harvard and a member of the Law School Dean's Advisory Council. Karen also serves as the chair of our annual green campaign, a position that she has held for several years, and we are grateful for her here. Betty Southern Murphy, founder at Hostetler, a former member of the Board of Trustees, and a entirely supportive of our institution. I mean, as I mentioned, this time and again, how we have people like Betty, you know, keeping on top of things, thinking in terms of the law school, opening up possibilities for us. If, you know, we would have done much more in our institution than I thank Betty. Kenny Wade, fifth class of 1979, recently retired for the American Bar Association, where she directed the section that focused on civil rights and liberties and constitutional law. She has been a member of, she's a member of the Lisa Washington House since in 2001, and is also very constant and supportive and development for the good causes in our institution. And now it's my pleasure to talk about the reason why we're here, with the recipient of the 2009 Women and the Law Leadership Award, Judge Dorothy Todd Beasley. Judge Beasley's impressive accomplishment would be reason enough to, for her to receive this award, but there is much more to share. She was a senior judge of the state of Georgia, which authorizes her to sit in Georgia court when called to a jurisdiction which needs additional or substitute assistant temporary. She served on the court for more than 15 years, from 1984 to 1999, serving as chief judge in 1995. She is the daughter of Judge Stephen Toth and Elizabeth Todd Toth. She graduated from Eastern Academy, St. Lawrence University, and American University, Washington College of Law, in 1964. She continued constantly her education, and this is something that we have seen all the time. When we talk with Judge Beasley, she's always thinking in possibility of learning and contributing more. She earned an LLM in the judicial process at the University of Virginia School of Law, as well as an LLM in international law from Emory University School of Law. Judge Beasley studied the English legal system at Oxford and has also participated in the program of instruction for lawyers at Harvard. After working for the U.S. Department of State, she attended law school and worked part-time for a congressman, a law firm, and the Urban Land Institute. Her first job as a lawyer was as law clerk to the three circuit judges in Arlington County, Virginia, where she then practiced with Sharon, Berg, and Nolan. After moving to Georgia, she worked first for the law firm of Fisher & Philip in Atlanta, then an assistant attorney general for the state of Georgia, representing the state in a number of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court and thereafter an assistant U.S. attorney criminal division. In 1977, she was appointed by Gardner Busby as judge of state court of Fulton County. She was elected in 78, and while running unopposed for re-election, in 84, was appointed to the Court of Appeals by Gardner Joe Frank Harris. Full terms following the election began January 87 and January 93. She's an associate member and has served on the board of directors of the National Center for State Courts and the American Judicatory Society. I could continue reading the impressive resume of Judge Beasley. It's important to know that in addition to her accomplishments and bar membership, she has distinguished herself by her volunteer efforts. But one in particular I would like to highlight today. Judge Beasley is a co-founder of Atlanta Table, a project of the Atlanta Community Food Bank, which collects and redistributes unused table-ready food for more than 40 major Atlanta nonprofit agencies. More than 40,000 pounds of food is distributed every month. This groundbreaking program has been so successful that it has been reproduced in cities nationwide through Feeding America. I would like also to tell the following. In my own human rights work, I see sometimes people that are genuinely committed to transformation of the society for the better. But when they see a person who suffers cancer, they do not do something individually. They're prepared to participate in the drafting of legislation or in the formulation of policy. But the compassion sometimes doesn't reach the individual story of the individual case. And in the case of Judge Beasley, we have seen that commitment, but also to complete men and women while the process of transformation continues in macro terms. Judge Beasley's commitment to the community extends to our own law firm, her loyalty had been unfailing. She joined Jenin's advisory council 7 years ago and hosted and had she's the president of both events with us in the Atlanta area. She never says no to any of our requests. This is not a commitment to get the same in the future. And provide us with warm southern hospitality whenever we have the pleasure of visiting the beautiful city of Atlanta. In 1993, she established a scholarship in memory of her parents, the Stephen and Beatrice Dodd Scholarship, to support a female student who excels academically. This scholarship is given annually, and Judge Beasley has taken great pride in communicating with the many recipients of this scholarship over the years. For over a decade, this fund has provided critical funding to our students who need assistance to fulfill their dreams of earning a legal degree. It is truly one of the cornerstones of our scholarship program, and we remain grateful to Jess Beasley for her dedication to this very special fund. She's then an important role model to all of us. We're grateful and honored that she's a member of our community, and then I would like her to invite her to come to the podium if we send her the leadership award of this year. Please.
somewhat shaken, I explained that I had been invited to lunch here by Dean Myers. Well, he said, then you must go around to the back door. Today, those of us who are women are as welcome as any man, and I checked this morning to be sure that I was correct in saying that women are now members of the Cosmos Club. Change has come. A barrier has fallen. I likewise experienced change for women in my judicial career. I served for nearly 22 years as a full-time judge, beginning with 7 years on the State Court of Fulton County, a trial court, and then nearly 15 on the Court of Appeals of Georgia. I was the only woman on those courts during the entire time, except for the last 3 months, when a woman who won the seat by election joined me. Now, 4 of the 12 judges on the Court of Appeals are women. The Chief Justice of Georgia is a woman, and the presiding justice, who will become chief in July, is a woman. Change has come. Barriers have fallen. And I have to say that this has come about not only because of the readiness of women who equip themselves to hold leadership positions, but also because certain men in power, be they bar leaders who influence elections, governors who appointed women, which is the way I started out, and those who have stood behind women all along, have helped us to get to the places where we've been. The challenge today, then, is to make use of the power and the influence which women now hold to effect change and remove barriers which still remain. There is, after all, only one woman on the Supreme Court of the United States. Let's move our thoughts from my own rather provincial experience to the wider scope of justice here for a moment. We have here today the founder of the International Association of Women Judges, the Honorable Arlene Pack. Would you stand up, Arlene, please? Come up with the moment. Some 18 years ago, she conceived the idea that women judges could work together to strengthen their institutions and judicial systems, advance women's leadership and women's rights, and lead the way for other women to follow. Now there are over 4,000 members at all judicial levels in some 87 countries. 4,000 in 87 countries. The present executive director of IAWJ, who succeeded Arlene, is Joan Winchip. Would you please stand? And while I'm about it, I'm going to divert for a moment. I'd like to introduce you to a few people that I asked to be invited here and who brought you to the storm to come. Susan Palmer Weatherall, because these are all leaders too. Would you stand up? That's my niece. On foreign elections for the International Foundation for Election Systems, and will be going to Nepal tomorrow to work on their upcoming election. Shola Jones, would you stand please? She's from Australia. And she's here with me now and was a colleague of mine at Emory, and we graduated last May with our LLMs. Charlie Rocha Spitzer, where are you? There she is. She's from Brazil. And she got her LLM from our Washington College of Law several years ago, and I met her at a WCL event in Atlanta. And now she's living here. And Carlisa Carson, would you stand please? She's an LLM student now at Georgetown Law School. Wants to be a law professor. And I have to tell you that you'll want to talk to her afterwards because she has worked on some of the Guantanamo Bay cases and particularly Hong Kong. So she was at Emory, you know, in one of our clinics at that law school. See, I've got 3 law schools. I just graduate from any place that'll have me. Well, surely one of the central challenges facing women in today's global legal environment continues to be equality. Since 1997, the IAWJ, which I just introduced to you, has tackled this head-on in its Jurisprudence of Equality program, or we call it JEP. And thus far, maybe this is higher now, it's provided training to more than 1,300 judges and allied professionals in 12 countries. More than that now?
More than that now,
okay. This training is an effort to bring the conventions on human rights that countries sign down to the local courts and help them to translate those when their countries have signed on. Is that about put it in a nutshell? Good. So they are bringing those conventions that have to do with human rights to where the rubber hits the road. The IAWHA conducts conferences for its members every 2 years, and I've attended several of these meetings, and I have met courageous women judges from such countries as Mongolia, Sri Lanka, Canada, Argentina. And I want to tell you about two of them, because their work is truly in the global legal environment. As I thought about that and getting ready to speak to you, I said, these two you have to know about. They exemplify the enormous impact which women judges can and do have in their respective spheres. When I attended the conference in Dublin, Ireland, I became acquainted with Judge Teresa Doherty of Northern Ireland. She's a petite and unassuming woman who loves to hike. She practiced law in Northern Ireland, and then her husband got a job teaching architecture in Papua New Guinea. So off she goes, and she says, well, now what am I going to do? So she started practicing law there by volunteering for legal aid, and did such a wonderful job. Her shining example as that and as co-founder of Legal Aid Clinics led to her appointment as a principal magistrate, and then as a judge of the Supreme and National Courts in Papua New Guinea. A news article about her 21 years as the, quote, iron woman of the legal fraternity of the South Pacific, end quote, paid tribute to her and said she left behind a legacy and foundation for the women folk of that country to strive to achieve their best. It described, and she told me about this, about going out to the prisons to see whether they really should be having the people that were there, and she would release those who were not properly in prison. She checked on the women in prison, and she made sure the prisoners would have enough to eat. She didn't just sit on a bench. Justice Doherty now serves on the Special Court for Sierra Leone, a unique tribunal created by agreement between the UN and the country of Sierra Leone to try war crimes, crimes against humanity, and other serious violations of humanitarian law, which were committed in Sierra Leone after November 1996. When I visited last November to that court as part of a judicial seminar, we observed part of the trial of Charles Taylor, former president of Liberia. Justice Doherty was presiding, and the tension of this high-level proceeding is still going on. It was palpable then, and you can imagine the stress she is under. The trial is so fraught with risks that it had to be moved from Freetown to The Hague. Of particular historic significance is Justice Doherty's partial dissent in a case against three other men, in which she painstakingly reviewed the horrific evidence of the so-called bushwives, of forced marriages, when women and girls were abducted in Sierra Leone and forced to perform servile wifely duties for combatants, and they were considered to belong to the combatants who claimed them. The indictment had charged this as coming within the statute's prohibition of, quote, other inhumane acts, end quote. Justice Doherty's colleagues on the trial court had dismissed that count of the indictment as being covered by the crime of sexual slavery. In dissent, she set out relevant law, history, treaties, and treatises, and concluded that forced marriage was not subsumed by the crime of sexual slavery, and that it was of sufficient gravity to meet the requirements of an, quote, other inhumane act, so as to constitute a crime against humanity. It had never been specified as such in any treaty provision, nor recognized before as a separate crime in any other tribunal, international. The appellate chamber agreed with her and stated that forced marriage is distinct from the crime of sexual slavery, and it does come within the statutory prohibition against other humane acts. This landmark contribution to the body of international criminal law stands as a beacon of hope then for subjugated women whose humanity lifts them from the status of mere property. Without her insightful scholarship, masterful exposition of law, and keen sense of justice, it's doubtful that it would have happened. And I am delighted to report that Justice Doherty is expected to be at the Gender and Justice Conference at our law school in mid-June. DV, as she would say, meaning God willing in Latin. Among the many women jurists around the world who are increasing in number and influence is Navanathan Pillay, who I first met at the IAWJ conference in Buenos Aires. At that time, she was on the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, elected by the UN General Assembly. She served there for eight years, four as president, and earlier she'd been the first woman appointed acting judge of the High Court of South Africa. As a practicing attorney, she assured that the threat would be a defense of sexual violence against the wife. And then she was appointed as one of the 18 judges of the new International Criminal Court, where she served on the appeals bench. That court, as you probably know, is the first permanent International Criminal Court. Of particular significance to us today in our study is that the court is committed to addressing the gravity of sexual violence. For example, as you know, it authorized an issuance of an arrest warrant for Omar al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, and one of the seven charges against him is rape as a crime against humanity. In addition, the court's cases in Uganda, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, and the Central African Republic include charges of rape, including sexual harassment, inducing rape, and other gender-based crimes. So the ICC is very aware of these gender-based situations. One of the challenges in today's global legal environment, then, is for the U.S. to join with 108 other countries by becoming a member of that court. And we must all see and urge that our government do so. You can catch up with that court on its own website or on the website of the Coalition for the International Criminal Court, which is www.iccnow.org, if you want to. But we've got to make sure our government joins. Judge Pillay served on the ICC until last September, when she assumed the awesome position as UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. But going back for just a minute, during her tenure on the Rwanda Tribunal, she was involved in major decisions which have contributed significantly to the development of international criminal law. And one particular, the conviction of Jean-Paul Akayesu, a Rwandan mayor, who was the very first person convicted of genocide by the International Criminal Court. What is of particular interest to us is that the opinion holds that rape can constitute a crime against humanity, and when it is directed to destroy a specific group, it constitutes genocide. Secondly, the conviction of genocide by guilty plea of Jean Kambamba, Rwanda's former prime minister, the first head of state to be held so accountable. Thirdly, the conviction of three Rwandans of using the media to incite genocide. The New York Times reported in a front page article that the three individuals, one a newspaper owner, the second one who controlled a popular radio station, and the third was the radio station's co-founder. They were convicted of using the media to mobilize the Hutu majority against the Tutsi, poisoning the minds of readers of the paper against the Tutsi, while the radio station openly called for their extermination, luring victims to killing grounds and broadcasting the names of people to be singled out. In sentencing, the one who controlled the radio station, Judge Pillay, said, without a firearm, machete, or any physical weapon, you caused the deaths of thousands of innocent civilians. To the newspaper owner, she said, instead of using the media to promote human rights, you used it to attack and destroy human rights. These are some of the challenges facing women today. And now that she is on the UN High Commission, she is the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, her leadership has reached even greater global proportions. With respect to the challenges facing women, her plan of action as High Commissioner reflects that she is committed to placing gender and women's rights at the core of the work of the office as a whole. To this end, a specific women's human rights and gender unit was established by a predecessor in 2006. In the office, and its work flows from the High Commissioner's role in legal standard setting with respect to inequalities. in relation to accessing justice in its broadest sense. There's also under her domain the Special Rapporteur on Violence Against Women, Its Causes and Consequences. And in her office is the committee, which is the body of experts which monitors implementation of CEDAW. You all know CEDAW is the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Hopefully, the U.S. will adopt that convention. That, too, is a challenge for us. And Penny Wakefield, I think, where are you?
Penny, there.
She's on the committee, I think, works on that, and it needs us to become a member of that as well. How many countries are members?
185.
So we've got a long way to go, and if we're looking for challenges as women, they are there. I have to mention, too, I shouldn't say just women, we have men here. And I want to mention in that regard, as relates to domestic violence, one of the members of our class at Emory, a young man who has pretty much so far devoted his attention to the elimination of domestic violence in his country of Nepal. Sue, I think you met him. And I just thought it was astounding that this young man who came to Emory to get further legal education as a young lawyer and working for an NGO against domestic violence in Nepal. So we do need the men too. The challenges which these two legal leaders, Teresa Doherty and Navi Pillay, address every day are in the realm of human rights on the international level. Although they operate on the global stage, we all know women leaders who are advancing human rights and improving human lives locally or nationally as well, no doubt, as many of you are here today. And for instance, how many of you saw the documentary film, A Powerful Noise? Did you? Oh, dear. It was shown in 450 theaters around the country one night. And when I called one of the movie theaters to make a reservation, it was sold out. I hope you have a chance to see it. It depicts three stories in which the impact of one woman's voice is being translated into the power of many women. Jacqueline Demelli is forging a change in the role of women in her town of Bamako, Mali, by providing an education, vocational skills, and job placement to girls who otherwise would remain illiterate. Nada Markovic, a survivor of the Bosnian War, has created there a women's association to improve their economic status through agricultural co-ops. And Nguyen Mai Han, a young HIV-positive woman in North Vietnam, started a self-help support group for those like herself struggling with the effect of HIV/AIDS. The group provides health care, counseling, and education, and thus builds inroads against isolation, ignorance, and ostracism. Well, these are three ordinary women in their towns who have been able to do this. While these three illustrations of women's empowerment are not directly law-changing endeavors, they each raise the status of women, whether by education, economic improvement, or health. They are in the business of the how to make equality. With these groundings, women are becoming equipped to speak out and bring the changes by which they can achieve more perfect equality in their societies. Just last week, we learned of the Afghan women who dangerously walked together to demand that Parliament repeal a new law that introduces Taliban-like restrictions on women and permits, among other things, marital rape. And if this seems remote to you, remember that the United States is hook, line, and sinker in Afghanistan. We're fighting a war there. Why? To overcome Al-Qaeda, but also to help them to establish democracy. That's what they want. That's what the polls show. And when the women had formed 46% of those registered to vote in the last election in Afghanistan. The education of women is obviously one of the foundational challenges to achieve equality. Greg Mortensen said it well. He's the mountain climber who became a builder of schools where women could learn in mountain villages in Pakistan and Afghanistan. His story is told in the book Three Cups of Tea. Based on his experience, Mortensen said, if you really want to change a culture, to empower women, improve basic hygiene and health care, and fight high rates of infant mortality, the answer is to educate girls. In addition to education, women's health is another challenge in today's global legal environment. There's not time enough to address it at length today, even though I gave you a little stretch break. But I call your attention to the March 2007 conference at Emory University Law School, I think you two were there in 2007, on world health and world law. Its focus was health issues of women in least developed and developing countries. We heard presentations on such subjects as women's right to health by Mary Robinson, model legislation for maternal and neonatal care, sexual trafficking of girls and young women. And that's not so far away either. I know in my own city of Atlanta, there's a special task force on sexual trafficking because it's so much in our city. And also we heard on issues on the establishment of world standards for protection of women's health. These papers are published in the Emory International Law Review if you're interested. And of course, one woman who did reach the top politically in her country and is using it in part to bring equality to women is Ellen Johnson Sirleaf of Liberia. Just last week, World Focus reported that now 13% of the police force are women in Liberia, and their goal is 20%. And that the Inspector General of the police force, and I think the Chief Deputy, are women. So the expectation is that now rape, which is the highest reported crime in the capital of Monrovia, and often involves young girls, will be vigorously attacked. President Sirleaf, it was reported, has created a special court exclusively for crimes of violence against women. I've touched ever so briefly on some of the challenges we're facing women in today's global legal environment and how they are being addressed in some specific ways. We have the challenge of placing qualified women in positions of leadership and influence on high levels, the challenge of recognizing and prosecuting crimes against women, both in international criminal law and in the domestic law of countries around the world. We have the challenge of the education of women so they can become decision makers, legislators, lawyers, and judges. And we have the challenges in health law as it affects women. Now let me ask you, what challenges do you see facing women in today's global legal environment? What change needs to happen? What barriers need to be overcome? Have you ever given any thought? Do you have any ideas now? I've only mentioned a few. Perhaps something that you're doing right now is working in this whole area. Those of you who are professors or students, those of you who are working for NGOs or for the government, are there any things you'd like to bring to us today? We're supposed to have a discussion, though our time is short. Well, Trishanna, you were right. They don't like to talk. So I will finish. Women's leadership, but think about it. What are the challenges? Women's leadership is more important today than ever before because of the critical global issues, the pace of change, and as Thomas Friedman shows in his book, the dynamics which are making the world hot, flat, and crowded. The good news is that there are ever greater efforts to educate women. And there are more opportunities for women to serve in positions to effect change and to eliminate barriers. Mary Robinson, former president of Ireland and a member of the Council of Women World Leaders, and I think she said there were now 30 of them, spoke on this last October at Ohio State University, showing that it is better for all of humanity for women to have a fuller role in decision making. All of us can participate in some meaningful way. And I'm reminded of the difference between eggs and bacon in a breakfast. The chicken, which produces the eggs, is involved. The pig is committed. So whether you are involved or are you wholly committed, if you leave here today with only one takeaway, let it be a resolve never to tire in advancing the status of women. As a supporter or a leader, a judge or an advocate, a teacher or a mentor, where you see a need, find a way to fill it. Thank you for being here today.